Again, welcome, namaste, and let me say dobry vecher to my Russian friends and Wai Shong Choi for, and then good evening and buenas tardes for the audience who are listening also on the, you know, the right. Okay, so let me give you you know, the overview. So this is the book that published by Cambridge Scholars Publishing in 2013. The book is called Multilingual Trends in a Globalized World, Prospects and Challenges. So in terms of the outline of the presentation, I'm going to give you the context of the book. So what that motivated me or that, you know, encouraged me to think about, you know, this book. Then the genesis of globalization, how this concept of globalization or globalized world, you know, emerged. Then current form of globalization and various perspective on it. And then I am also going to give you an overview on globalization and the need for multilingualism, why we need to think about that. And what are some of the trends that going on that people are calling multilingual trends in a globalized world? And then a brief overview of the book and some highlights, considering the limitation that I have a copyright with, you know, agreement with the publisher, so I cannot delve in a very detail, but I can, you know, give you some of the highlights. And then the concluding remarks, conclusion, and some feedback and reflections. So, let's give you the context of the book. So, you know, over 3 decades, or you can say over a couple of decades, very significant economic, political, and social changes have occurred across the globe. The identities of all societies are evolving. It's getting, you know, reinterpreted. With the, you know, the shrinking boundaries, and with the day-to-day advancement of, you know, the information technology, and also the frequent movement of the people. The impact of a globalized world is immense and multifaceted. It's not just one, you know, economic or cultural or social. It's so multidimensional. It has so many aspects. Globalization is redefining social, cultural, and political realities of the various communities and various, you know, nations and nation states across the globe. So it is very challenging to explore innovative, you know, meaning-making approaches and strategies to prepare future generation for the coming, you know, new world, which is no longer unipolar or bipolar, but multipolar, you know. So in terms of global citizenship, the concept of the global citizenship, where the social cooperation is the norm. If nobody can, okay, I am the superpower and I can impose you, that's not going to happen. That's time has gone. Okay? So that's, you know, the context of this book. So then question in this book, I have posed a series of questions. So as I, you know, the book looks on globalization with a various perspective. So the question I arise, is it a process? Or is it a globalization is a new theory? Or is it just a mere concept? Or is it a new phenomenon? It has never happened before. Is it solely economic or beyond that? Is it a dialectic of domination versus resistance? Is it a new form of colonization? Is it a multifaceted and multidimensional? So let us, you know, in a minute I'm going to show you and share with you something that will give you some perspective that it's not one but many, you know, things embedded in it. So with reference to genesis of globalization, I would say it is as old as human civilization. Why I say that? You know, the world has recognized that the Hindu civilization, I'm not talking about the religion, religion is a new concept, but Hindu civilization that flourished in the lap of Himalayas have flourished million years. It's not the thousand years, but the million years. And the oldest scripture on the planet is called the Rig Veda. Oh, that is also the Hinduism book. But now I'm quoting one of the holiest book of the Hinduism, Bhagavad Gita, where is a term appear, Vasudhav Kutumbakam, which means that the whole universe is a family, and all creatures, not just the human being, are, you know, family members, they are ours. That's the concept. Okay. So that is, you know, the genesis in terms of mythological perspective, you know, because I am a Hindu, so I can look up from that perspective. But it's not that. Let's take, you know, a look on this video. But before, just a minute, before we go for the video, I would also like to point out that at the same time, when, you know, one very well-known poet, English poet, Rudyard Kipling, wrote his masterpiece, We and They, okay, where, you know, he has compared the various communities, but he's also, you know, being criticized for his interpretation, which was a very much racial biased and stereotyping, okay? But at the same time, you can read what he has said. He said that the Asian peoples, especially we Indians, gobble our food with dirty hands, while the Western eats everything with the, you know, the fork, with the cow horns. And I'm not going to, you know, kind of things.
जूता है जापानी ये पतलून इंग्लिस्तानी सर पे लाल टोपी रूसी फिर भी दिल है हिंदुस्तानी मेरा जूता है जापानी
सो द क्लिप दैट आई जस्ट डेमोंस्ट्रेटेड बिफोर यू इज फ्रॉम अ मूवी Bollywood movie, the name was Sri 420. And the movie was so popular, not only in India, but also in Russia, in Japan, and, you know, in abroad. And at that time, when Rudyard Kipling and other Western poets were trying to, you know, depict in a very racial way, the Indian poets are thinking about globally. Even I am wearing something from Russia, something from Japan, my heart is Indian, my heart is Chinese, my heart is Korean, my heart is Spanish, that type of, you know, the feeling. So it's not just the mythological thing. And at the same time, the book has quoted Mahatma Gandhi, who used to say that, I don't want my house to be walled, I want to have the fresh air. I'm just, you know, paraphrasing him, that fresh air from across the lands. But I don't want to be blown off by any. So I want to have my roots. I want to respect diversity. I want to have the, you know, the multilingual perspective, multicultural perspective, but I also want to be who I am. Okay. So then the question arises that the term is not new. The notion of globalization is not new since it has been interpreted in many different ways. You know, I have also quoted in the book of Marx and, you know, his colleagues who have also interpreted how this new form of globalization emerged in the 15th centuries, you know, and on and on. Now, but besides that, even if we just go into history books or, you know, political science book or any, we see some of the, you know, the forms of globalization like colonization, missionary activities. That's very important when we talk about multilingual concept. Because as the missionaries, you know, went across the globe, they also promoted indirectly indigenous languages, local languages, as they try to reach out, you know, the local people in their language and culture. Then there are a series of alliances like NATO, which still exists, Warsaw Pact. Warsaw Pact was, you know, an association of, you know, the former USSR, led by former USSR and all, you know, the socialist communist nations, large number. But then, the parallel to that was another association which still exists, is called Non-Aligned Movement. So either no longer associate with the NATO or Warsaw Pact, but independent, like Nehru, Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia and many others, they proposed. Globalization has become the most significant and widely used term, implying, I'm just, you know, quoting some individuals who have said that the global homogenization and local hybridity. And again, I'm going to present something which will, you know, give you perspective whether or not the world is homogenizing, but at the same time also hybridizing. Now, then what actually really push forward this concept of globalized world, globalization? So there are certain behind-the-scene things that happen, which very often people, you know, didn't talk about that. So we have to think about emergence of internet. Hotmail was, you know, the creator, developed by Dr. Sabir Bhatia, and later he sold, you know, to the Microsoft. And then after that, you know, the Google come, Gmail, etc., series of. Then, that was in 1983. Then the collapse of Berlin Wall in 1989. And I'm coming to that also, why that happened. Then Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing in 1989. That was also very, you know, world-shaking event. The people are still, just imagine, oh my God, what would have happened there. Nobody knows exact number. And then WTO GATT, you know, with reference to the trade agreements, etc. But with all these things, there is also a new movement was taking place, the emergence of rural people, rural leader. And I'm going to show you how researchers have interpreted that. Emergence of a rural leader, Lalu Prasad Yadav in 1990 in India, which galvanized the entire world, the people of the middle class. And open door policy of India in 1991, and end of apartheid and release of Nelson Mandela in 1994. So these are some of the major milestones that really pushed this concept of globalized world, globalization. But the credit for the recent form of globalization, whether people like it or dislike it, it's a different thing, goes to the greatest leader of the 20th century, according to BBC and Time magazine, Mikhail Gorbachev. When he introduced his policy that was called Glasnost and Perestroika, which was basically liberalization of economy and democratization of the political process, social process. And once he said, I'm just, you know, quoting him, the market is not an invention of capitalism. It has existed for centuries. It is an invention of civilization. Unquote, Gorbachev. As I said, emergence of a rural leader. So one, you know, researcher, I'm just quoting one, Sontag, she has given that how Lalu Prasad has cultivated the image of common man. He projects this image globally, showing up at IMF headquarters in Washington, D.C., speaking in his rural English, which people can barely understand, with the mixing of, you know, Hindi. Now we use the term Hinglish, Chinglish, you know, so many English, so that kind of things. He projected across the globe as a new emergence of mass people, leader, that come from the, you know, the ground. People feel very much associated with him. Now he is also being studied at Harvard for his business model that, you know, turned around the Indian Railway. Unfortunately, Indian Railway is again in very deficit because of, you know, the various factors. I'm not going to there. But he is being studied at Harvard. His model is also being studied at Harvard. And then, you know, you see there are different interpretation of the globalization. Globalization is a process. Globalization is a theory. You know, it's more than that. It has, you know, the various aspects. And based on that, what I have, you know, interpreted in my book and also in some of my publication, that globalization is compression of the world, shrinking of political boundaries, frequent movement of people, intermingling of cultures, and global dominance and local resistance. And that's what we see happening everywhere. You know, the far right wing in Germany, in France, in Russia, or even in India. Here, Tea Party. It's everywhere. And then, you know, some other, you know, the definitions. I'm not going to give, but I just try to... So what you see in this slide, the people have interpreted from economic perspective, financial perspective. So Zakaria said that when today people think about globalization, they still think about swapping of $1 trillion, you know, for rewarding some and punishing others. That was, you know, he said. For others, it's the relentless integration of economies, societies, and cultures in a borderless, not all which is pleasant. Not everything the people are, you know, the liking. They're also, you know, that's what I have interpreted, the local resistance, and many others have said as well. Then there is another video. So this, you know, in my book, I have also quoted Shakira's this song to just emphasize that how world is intertwined and accepting the diverse perspective. If you go the background of this song, the song was based on African context. It also has a best, you know, the sports, you know, the soccer sports. The song is composed by African composer, performed by an Spanish speaker of, you know, speaking national of Colombia. And the first song ever that got only on YouTube more than 1 billion hit. Okay. Now, the book has very, you know, focused on linguistic and cultural perspective. So, with the reference to the linguistic perspective, the people have interpreted that being able to speak English is a symbol of power. It's a gateway. It's giving you a passport to go anywhere in the world. But not everybody is, you know, welcoming it. Some have also seen it as a new form of colonization. English is the language of instruction, is a big business for English-speaking countries such as the United States, Britain, Canada, and Australia. Billion and billion of dollars business is English language teaching. So, you know, that is one perspective. Then others have also said that in the rush to participate in the global movement, the spread of English can potentially wreak havoc on many other cultures and languages. And in the book, when I come to the latter, give you the overview, with reference to diglossia, some languages are being reduced to the L variety because of the emergence and the importance of English. Then globalization from cultural perspective. Some scholars have argued that the various forces of global cultural globalization assault on different local cultures and traditions. The creating a culturally homogenized world, imposing American and or Western cultural practices. The others have said it are more cross-cultural encounters. So it's not just the homogenization, but it's also heterogenization. And that you will be see in another video and another clip that will give you the more perspective.
The theme of fast food versions of local delicacies continues in Asia, with things like rice burgers in Singapore, the vegetarian Michaloo tiki burger in India, the ebi filet shrimp burger in Japan, and the taro pie in China. But other items don't seem to have any connection to local cuisine. Pizza puffs in India. And I don't know where this bubblegum squash McFlurry came from that they're selling in Australia and New Zealand. Sounds like that should be a McToothpaste. Buzz 60. Now you know. Pass it on.
So this small video clip is self-explanatory that how the world is homogenized with the consumption of, you know, the Western food, but it has their own flavor. So, you know, the book very specifically said that in India, no food chain like McDonald's, you know, KFC or Pizza Burger, whoever are going, can afford to use beef and pork, given the social context there. Similarly, you know, there are many other contexts. Now look, the people are consuming cola across the globe, and that's what they have, you know, noted on their website. How many the beverage choices they are offering, and the people are, you know, they're accepting across the globe. Again, it's 1.9 billion servings. And, you know, how many billion their business, that's the, you know, the concern and the interpretation for the business people. But the point I try to make with this that the world is homogenizing, but also heterogenizing. Everybody is having their own flavor, their own identity. And that's the, you know, gave the new concept or new emergence, what people are now referring is transculture. Translingualism, you know, trans world. Globalization is also being referred as trans world. So kind of things. Okay. Now, with reference to multilingualism, as I said, some societies, some, you know, communities always happen to be multilingual, like in India or in African context. Or even in Europe, you know, so much diversity. So, but the real push for multilingualism came when UNESCO's, you know, the position paper refers to, you know, the first time the term they used, the multilingual world. Before that, they are just using, you know, world, but at that time in 2003, they used the term multilingual world, and I have cited their things with a UNESCO General Conference Resolution 1999. They have categorized what kind of practices are called multilingual. It needs to have three levels of education. One, national or official language, you know. Another, the mother tongue or indigenous language, and the third would be international language. It needs to have the three level of, you know, the instruction, level of policies to be known as multilingual. But that's, you know, the one interpretation of multilingualism. The book, you know, has interpreted in so many ways, and it has looked at various aspects. If you look from the European Union perspective, they have interpreted multilingualism and plurilingualism very different ways. Multilingualism with reference to society, but the plurilingualism with reference to individuals, you know, and so many things. So then question arises, why do we need to talk about multilingualism? Now, this one has said that it is multilingualism that has kept humanity, civilization, separated by so many languages together. It's the multilingualism that the people are interacting, respecting, you know, and seeing the diversity. I can go further, and many have others also said that. Without diversity, no creativity. If I am a fluent speaker of English, do you have any need to have any kind of, seeking your using different type of strategies, body language, etc., etc.? If I am looking like you, I am using the same food, everything. But since I have a heavy accent, which is, English, I am a multilingual, that is also being, I speak 7 languages, understand couple more. So the point is that, it's the multilingualism, it's the diversity that, foster creativity, imagination, or all kind of innovation. Now, the others have said that marginalized people who undergo culturally and linguistically appropriate education are better equipped to get the benefits of this globalized world, serve, to their community on a very personal basis, on a very, one-to-one, you can say, on a wider society level, because they have a broader understanding. Then, in Indian census reported, 2001, they have not reported, the other census, 1,656 languages spoken in India, according to the Indian census, in which 57 languages with more than a million speakers. However, in some areas, children are being educated in language that is not theirs, and they are being disadvantaged. So we need to have, the multilingualism. So that's is there. Now, even in the United States, again, 2011 census doesn't have any linguistic reference, but 2001 census refers 302 home languages spoken in U.S. New York alone has, I think, 128. It's a, the counting can be. Just in Queens, more than 108 languages spoken just in Queens County. It's such a diverse. Now, again, Zakaria have said that Americans have not had to reciprocate by learning foreign languages, cultures, and markets. The spread of English for others gives them an understanding of and access to 2 markets and cultures. They can speak English, but also Mandarin, or Hindi, or Portuguese, and so on. That is a disadvantage for English-speaking people, according to Zakaria. Then, but we also have some very promising programs going on across the globe. And one of the programs is called the FOER program in Belgium, which develops, the more than one language competency at a time. Now, but not only that much, language and cultures are very intertwined. It's the part and parcel of, any culture, any society. And in my view, I have interpreted it as, I take it as a baggage. So you buy one, you get one free. There are some exceptions where people have tried to devoid, completely cut them off from culture or language. But in most cases, if you try to learn a language, you are also learning in one way or another, a culture. If you want to learn culture, or you are learning a culture, you are also learning in one way or another their language. It's so intertwined. So I call it a baggage. It always comes in a baggage. You like it or not, but it always comes. You buy one, get one free. Like that kind of concept. Then, do we have real multilingual trends in a globe that the people are referring to, or UNESCO or other, have quoted? this, we do have some very promising things going on. So some have said that bilingualism and multilingualism, the use of more than one language in daily life, is a normal practice these days. It's no longer exception. Previously it used to, you know, interpreted as, oh, it's exception for some who have no other understanding, so they can speak in their local language. Now if you speak four or five languages when you are walking, nobody can say that, oh, you are, you know, very illiterate, or you don't have, you know, linguistic repertoire or cultural repertoire, etc. So that kind of thing. Now, in many parts of the world, multilingualism and innovative approaches to education that involve the use of two or more languages constitute, you know, again, there are around 200 countries in the world that recognize two or more official languages. I have given some example like India, Luxembourg, Nigeria, Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, Malaysia, South Africa. These are just the few. New Zealand, there are many. You know, I cannot list entire world, but I'm just giving some example. South Africa has declared 11 official languages in its constitution. It has recognized 11 official languages. Now, in New Zealand, between 1996 and 2006, the number of multilingual people increased by over 43%. Just in rural, you know, the Auckland, over 25% were reported to speak more than one language. One-fifth of children in the United States were reported to live with one foreign-born parent. And nearly half of them speak English fluently and another language. As I said, just in Queens, 108 or more languages spoken. And that was in, you know, American Community Survey in 2010. Look up the, you know, the statistics presented by Encyclopedia Britannica. In terms of the world's most spoken language by total speakers, combined native, non-native, you know, lingua franca, all. And I'm not going to read them, but you can see that it's not just one language, it's no longer English has the dominance, but there are many others. Similarly, most widely spoken language by numbers of native speakers. And here, English is in number third. Spanish is in number second. Hindi and Urdu is number four. And so on and on. Again, I'm not going to, you know, kind of thing. That is based on the Ethnologue 2013. When the, you know, the book published. So, I think the report came in June, the book published in July. So, multilingual practices in the U.S. Now, even in United States, it has a prolonged history of, you know, multilingualism. Many people do not, you know that or just try to ignore that. Again, I'm not, you know, here to prove or disprove anything, but that was perhaps the reason the founding fathers of United States didn't put English as an official language or national language of the nation. So Garcia and others have quoted that in 1790s, which did not include the Native Americans and African slaves at that time, 25% of the American citizens spoke languages other than English. Multilingualism, multicultural practices are common thing in 1790. Now, in terms of the recent, and again, I'm not going to know. So if you are interested to know much more about United States history, you can go and read my another book, which is Globalization and Its Impact on Teacher Education Trends, Language Teacher Education Trends in United States. That was what, you know, I published for my dissertation, and that I also published a book, which through a Lambert Academic Publishing, that's also, you know, available. But here I am just, you know, giving with the reference to multilingual practices, you know, in United States. In 2001, at that time, the President Clinton signed an executive order that made compulsory for any individual, any association, any organization to provide, you know, multilingual services to the people who receive federal funds or grants. But not, you know, this is just the, you know, the government perspective. The book also has a chapter on the parental perception towards multilingualism. You know, do they like their children to be multilingual, bilingual, have the, you know, the perspective about other languages and cultures? Some studies have pointed to that. So, Kingston and Fogley study, in which they asked a sample of well-educated, mostly professional bilingual couples of Washington, D.C., they said that their first job is to produce and nurture bilingual kids, multilingual kids, in terms of, you know, their expression. Even in 39th annual, you know, Phi Delta Kappa Gallup poll, 85%, you know, the participants, the parents, viewed that learning a second language was a very or somewhat important, and 70% felt that second language instruction should begin in elementary school. Now, just an overview of the book. As I said in the very beginning, I am bound by, you know, the contract, so I cannot go much, you know, in the depth. So as you look up the 9 chapters, which I try to have, you know, more pedagogical implications, lot of explanation, etc. But when you write a book, you have lot of constraints. You cannot go as you wish. You have to, you know, go with the wish of the publishers and, you know, the various other things. So even that, I try to, you know, put the information in a very compact way, but I haven't, you know, compromised with my intent. So you can see that I have started with looking globalization through linguistic and cultural lenses, and then I have ended with my chapter 9, globalization and changing parental perception for multilingualism, and in between. So, you know, this book is a resource for many linguists, undergraduates, graduates, you know, teachers, activists, political leaders, and so on and on. And what I have, you know, just tried to give you some highlights. So, for example, I have interpreted the diaglossic communities and languages of instructions. This is not my term. The concept of diaglossia emerged with the Charles Ferguson concept when he brought with examples of H variety and L variety. So a particular language like Arabic, Tamil, Greek, there are two different varieties used in totally mutually exclusive way, either or, neither, no, not in an intermingled way. So like standard or, you know, the very Quranic Arabic cannot be used in conversation. Similarly, the high level of Tamil cannot be used in day-to-day communication. So that was his, you know, the initial concept. Later, Fishman and others have expanded that. It's not just one language has, you know, the two varieties. Sometimes it can work in terms of bilingualism plus diglossia minus, or diglossia plus bilingualism minus, or bilingualism plus diglossia plus, or both minus and minus, in that kind of things. So what I have, you know, reinterpreted that, in today's world, we see many languages are being used in a diaglossic way. For example, I'm just, you know, giving one example. Russian language is one of the powerful, you know, very most influential language in the world, as you have just seen. But if you go to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, it just reduced to the social family communication language only. The official language, national language, has high variety is the different. Here in United States, with some exceptions, you can see that the English is in a very high status, Spanish and many other languages in, you know, the low status. But there are some promising things that I really interested, I found very interesting. That one language in Vietnam, it's called Eastern Cham, was existed in very low variety in terms of the colloquial form, the vernacular. But later, it was found that that language also has a very high and prestigious variety inscripted on some, you know, stone, which were very similar to Sanskrit, because their origin was also Sanskrit. That's what I said, you know, Hindu civilization has a million years history, it's very debatable, I'm not going there. And that was, they called, you know, the Akhar Thara. That's the, you know, their very high variety. Now, that is being revitalized. The high variety that only existed on in inscription is being used for teaching, you know, also producing some radio program, some newspaper articles, etc. That's very promising in terms of how an L variety that existed, you know. Similarly, if you go to Paraguay, where Guarani was an indigenous language, only existed before in L variety, in terms of, you know, the diglossic thing. Now it's also getting some official status because of the declaration of 2007 indigenous rights of the, you know, kind of thing. And there are many. But there are some disheartening thing also happening in Luxembourg. Luxembourg is a language that was very rich for, you know, the people of Luxembourg. Now it's being reduced as a social communication means only. It's the English that has very high prominence for business, job, etc., etc. So that's, you know, the thing I have presented here. And with reference to bilingualism, multilingualism, and code switching, that has also reinterpreted nowadays. I'll give you an example. As, you know, if you walk on a, you know, any road or any, you know, any train or anywhere, any place, and if you code switch, you know, Mandarin to English, English to, you know, Hindi, Hindi to Japanese, Korean, it's acceptable. The people have called it, you know, the translanguaging, you know, code mixing in a very positive way. And in fact, I have an example that it works. I very often used translanguaging for my teaching here at, you know, the Bronx Community College of the CUNY. Whenever, and also other places, whenever I taught classes like English, and I have speakers of Spanish, Bengali, Hindi, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, I allow them to have interaction in, you know, in their small groups so that they can understand better and make their reflection. And it's working. It's very promising. And in the end, I just try to wrap up my talk with two reviewers' note, and again, I'm not going to read it. You can see one reviewer said that this book achieves its goal of relating current trends in language education to the larger phenomena of globalization. It excels at succinctly presenting the mirrored manifestation of those trends around the globe and various related topics, all while maintaining one unifying narrative thread language diversity is a resource to be valued rather than problematized. While, the another professor have said again that 9 compact chapters of this interesting book cover what by all measure is a complete survey course on bilingualism. He has said that in again, central topics that receive serious language policy, language learning, include diglossia across language interaction, code switching, the things that I have covered, specialists in related fields find it to be handy reference volume. And here, the things so far I can say you that this book is being used across the globe. More than 50 universities have it in various volume. Despite the fact that the publisher has put very high price, it's published from United Kingdom, and they put very high price, but even that, the book is being used across the globe. So thank you so much for coming, and this wraps up, my presentation. So thank you, and if you have any questions, you're very welcome. Thank you.